Nothing clean, right? Your clothes, give them to me, now. Hello and welcome to another edition of the Narrative First Podcast, the weekly podcast where story is always king. I am your host, Jim Hull, the voice of Narrative First, and this is episode 52, Handling Subplots with the Dramatica Story Form. Welcome back, everyone, to another week of story structure and story analysis. Last night was the Dramatica Users Group meeting. This is a meeting where a collection of Dramatica story experts and people new to the community arrive and we analyze a film. Last night's film was The Jungle Book, the Jon Favreau version from 2016. And it was really great because last night was the first time in forever that there were more than a handful of people. I mean, it's been slowly building up this year for some reason, but last night there was at least 12, maybe 15 people in there. And it reminds me of the user group meetings from the late 90s and early 2000s when there would be close to 20, 30 people in the class, like an actual honest class. And it was great because there was so much back and forth and so many different opinions. And the other thing was there's a great mix of male and female, which is always a nice thing, since if you know anything about the Dramatica story form, you know that people with a tendency towards linear problem solving have a huge problem trying to understand and identify a holistic way of thinking. So if for some reason the main character in the story actually has a holistic problem solving style, the guys that are there trying to figure it out will have difficulty empathizing with that character and actually identifying what it is that's going on with them. And it's always nice too, because the holistic point of view, we always go in a very linear, progressive way through the class. We start with identifying the four through lines. We're breaking everything down into the parts, the essential parts. And so we tease apart everything. We start with the four through lines. Once we identify those, then we do the character dynamics, and we just work our way step by step through that. And then the story dynamics. And then we get down into the theme browser and basically work our way down, starting at the biggest and breaking it down to the smallest. And I know this drives holistic people crazy because they can just look at the model and instantly see all the connections between everything. I mean, I thought it was great last night. Makiko, who is somebody that I've worked with before on different features, she, whenever she identifies the main character where the domain is and the through line, she always looks to see where the influence character is, always tries to see the relationship, because the main character and influence character relationship, or the relationship between them, between their through lines, they're always arranged in a dynamic diagonal configuration. So if the main character through line is in universe, that means that the influence character domain will be in mind. If the main character domain is in psychology, that means the influence character's domain will be in physics. And so whenever she doesn't ever just identify one through line, she always identifies the two, which is always looking towards the relationship. And I thought that was really great because there was more than just one female. Actually, there was more than zero females in the audience last night or at the class. And it was great just to get a wide range of understandings and viewpoints and opinions. And I know from when I was teaching at CalArts, which I've probably said a million times before, so I'm sorry if I keep repeating myself, but I had one student who she would always leap right down to the bottom and point out exactly where the problem is, and it would drive me crazy because I would have to wait and tell her to wait for 30 minutes until everybody else could catch up. So likely there's a different approach. It would be very interesting to see somebody who's more geared towards a holistic methodology of problem solving. It would be really interesting to see how they would actually approach handling a user group meeting, because I'm sure it would be a completely different experience altogether. Actually, it would probably be more about the experience of the thing than the actual process of going through it. So last night, yes, we did The Jungle Book, which was great. It's a very, it's not the simple story form that, or the classic story form that you've seen a million times, which is usually in self-interest, the issue of self-interest with pursuit and avoid as the problem and solution pair. But it's really close. It's like the second runner-up, third runner-up, where you still have the same genre elements where you find the main character domain in universe and the overall story domain in physics, because it's all about killing Mowgli. And then Mowgli, of course, is a human in the jungle, a man cub. But instead of that lower left, you know, future, obtaining, becoming, and subconscious concerns, it's actually in the upper right, which is kind of the boy, quote unquote, Pixar. Actually, I guess it's Pixar, quote unquote, boy area, where you have progress, doing, being, and preconscious. So the way Dramatica works, or at least the way that narrative works, each of the domains have a certain concern that they look to see that this is where the source of problems are in that through line. And a consistent story, one that has everything lined up where it should be, all the concerns will have the same sort of flavor to them. So as I just mentioned, Jungle Book was progress, doing, being, and preconscious. And those are all in the upper right-hand corner. So if you have the actual Dramatica table of story elements, if you know the model, the four different towers of conflict, you can actually look in the upper right, and that's where all the concerns are exactly the same. The typical story form, the one that's used a zillion times, I was just watched Terminator. It's free on HBO. If you don't already have it on HBO, streaming is Terminator, which is always great. Nothing clean, right? Your clothes, give them to me now. You know that? Oh boy, I'll have to work on that one. So that has the classic problem and solution of pursuit is the problem and the solution is a void. So obviously the Terminator is coming in to pursue her, and it's not until she actually fights back to try and prevent him that she's able to save the day. And you know what? There's, excuse me. You know what? There's a discussion because we did an analysis of that film. I believe we'd already done it once before, and then we revisited it because I had an issue with the ending I think it was the mental sex. Sorry. So mental sex is problem solving style, which is that whole linear holistic thing. We had originally done an analysis of it, I believe, back in 97. And I believe the story form was off. Oh, this would be a great thing to put back up. But then there was a discussion on when I made everybody use Google Plus for a short while. There was a discussion there about going over the story form. And we actually changed it and came up with one that was clearer and better, more accurate of the narrative dynamics in there. And I will leave that. I will leave a link to that in the show notes. And actually, maybe I'll write a post about it. That film has the... God, I'm all over the place this morning. Excuse me. That has the problem of pursuit and the solution of avoidance. That's the classic one. So when I went into the Jungle Book analysis last night, two things. One, I forgot the camera, so I had to hold my phone the entire time, which actually I think turned out better because I did a more dynamic presentation, and you can actually see other people instead of just Chris the whole time. So you'll have to let me know if that's better once I finally get that up. I'm also slightly behind. I have 2 months worth of videos to put up there. So I'd forgotten the camera. I basically listened the entire time, and I had felt that maybe it was in future obtaining, becoming, and subconscious, because it just felt very familiar to me. And I thought, well, it's all about killing him, and they're worried about what the man cub will become and, you know, his future. So, and obviously as an animator, I'd seen the original film, which has no story whatsoever, purposefully episodic, especially since Disney told them to throw the book away. And so I had my own sort of preconceptions to it that I was probably projecting on. So that's why I kind of just stayed quiet. And so when they pointed out being, doing, preconscious, it was like, oh yeah, because it's all about how you have to be in the jungle. You know, you have to be, there's certain ways to act, certain things you need to do, that kind of stuff. And then when we went down, it was Sandy who jumped right to the issue of experience and expectation and determination. So this is a way, so there isn't an iOS version of Dramatica yet. Currently there isn't, perhaps soon. Currently there isn't a version of it. So the only reason, which somebody joked to me later, was the only reason you actually need to bring a computer anywhere is so that you can run the Dramatica Story Expert application. But if you don't have access to it and you want to be able to get the story form, or at least get as close as you can to it, there's a easy trick that takes a little bit of mental wrangling, but once you have it figured out, you'll be able to do it. And the idea is that, excuse me, let me drink some water here. Okay, so the idea is that the changed character shares the same problem and solution as the overall story. This is how narrative works. This is the secret to everything. So the main character will share the same problem and solution as the overall story, and the steadfast character, whether it's the main character or influence character, will share the same symptom and response as the overall story. So once again, I'll just say it because I think I might have just said it wrong. The changed character, whether it's the main character or influence character, will share the same problem and solution as the overall story, and the steadfast character will share the same symptom and response as the overall story. That way you get the two different perspectives on the same sort of problem, and that's where the meaning comes from, because you get to see kind of the problem from within, from the subjective point of view, and also from without, the objective point of view. So in last night's film, in The Jungle Book, let me refer back to Terminator, since probably a lot of people have seen that. As I mentioned before, the overall story problem is pursuit and the solution is avoidance. And Sarah Connor is the changed character. This is the first film. She's the changed main character. And Reese is the influence character. He's the one that's challenging her. So in Terminator, she's the changed character. So she has her main character problem is pursuit, which is something that's... The main character problem is something completely separate from the overall story. So obviously she's being pursued in the overall story through line perspective. But from the main character through line perspective, it's the idea that guys are pursuing her or hitting her on her. And the fact that guys aren't pursuing her, you know, the guy that cancels the date on her. So it's like, it's this idea of like, there's nobody out there that wants me, that thing. And guess what? There is somebody out there that wants you, just not in the way that you think they want you. So she shares the same problem and solution as the overall story. And if you didn't have the Dramatica Story Expert application and you're trying to figure it out, you could figure it out just by having the chart. That's all I have, is I have the chart as a PDF in Dropbox. And I just quadrangulate. So I look, and obviously the overall story would be in self-interest, pursuit and avoid. And then I look over at she's not in the future. See, she's in subconscious, innermost desires. So I go down there and I look and I see, oh, closure. Okay, yeah, she can't bring anything to an end. It's either the issue of she can't find somebody, or everything just keeps ending. And then so that her problem is pursuit and her solution is avoidance. And then you go over to Mr. Reese, and he's over there with control uncontrolled, because he shares the same symptom and response as the overall story, which I believe is in the future under preconception. So, but his issue is openness. Wow, totally all over the place. So let me just get down to the basics of this so I could get back to the Jungle Book. I really thought I would have nothing to talk about today. I'm just super excited about everything that happened last night and everything that is going to happen. The changed character shares the problem and solution, and the steadfast character shares the symptom and response. So in the Jungle Book, Mowgli is the steadfast character, right? He is the man who has the ingenuity and the tools, and he finds a way to be accepted into the wolf pack by using his tools. And he changes Bagheera and Baloo, who we found out were the shared influence character perspectives. They kind of share the different perspective on how a different way to approach problems. They are the change character. So it was Sandy who identified very quickly the consistent pairing of expectation and determination, which is in an issue of experience under a concern of doing. And expectation and determination, if you go over to progress and you look under threat, that's where you also find expectation and determination. If you're listening to these podcasts in a row, you remember last week I was talking about the threat of gun control and that sort of stuff, and whether or not there'd be a problem of theory and a solution of hunch. Remember that? Well, in the Jungle Book, the problem for Mowgli is hunch, and his solution would be theory, which never really happens. So he's driven by hunch, and I thought it was great because it's this idea, is he's the steadfast character, so that's not really his problem. That's a source of drive. That's what motivates him. That's what creates drive in his perspective. And it's the idea that this hunch that he's going to grow up to be just as deadly as his father, or, you know, how the hunch about what men are like and whether or not he will grow into that killing instinct. You know, that man instinct and the threat, not only the threat that people pose to him from Shere Khan or tigers pose to him, but also the threat he poses to everybody else. So that's his issue. So that gives you a symptom of determination and a response of expectation. So there, you know, it's been determined the way he should act, and he's not living up to expectations. And then that crosses over the same symptom and response with the overall story of the Jungle Book. And then that gives you a problem and solution in the overall story, a problem of non-accurate and a solution of accurate. And that means, of course, that Bagheera and Baloo share the same problem and solution. So last night, you know, when we found that the connection between Baloo and Bagheera, that they're both play as influence characters, it was interesting because Bagheera is kind of takes the influence character perspective, and Baloo is the one responsible for the relationship story through line. There's a lot of manipulation, a lot of psychology going on about, you know, convincing him to go up there to get all the honey for him. Kind of the heart of the story is between Baloo and Mowgli, which is exactly how it was in the original film. But the influence character, that challenging perspective, is coming from Bagheera, which is really interesting to have it kind of split that way evenly. It works for the film. And then Chris mentioned something about how theoretically you could have a relationship story that has nothing to do with the actual influence character. It's just really, really odd. So here's Chris talking about that.
So this is the overall story. We go on activity, which means the relationships down here in psychology or manipulation. And while you see, I think, little of the relationship psychology part with Bagheera, because he's just not terribly, he's not very adept at it. You see him a little bit more on Mowgli's side, I think, trying to use psychology against Bagheera. But you see a lot more of it with Baloo. I think that's, the relationship is a lot stronger with Baloo. Although I think the influence character perspective is a lot stronger with Bagheera.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is why I think they share it, but they're not sort of showing the same parts of it. And I think that's it's kind of a strange thing to do. It's completely okay. I mean, you can have subjective characters that fill in the relationship through a line. Even some that don't appear anywhere else in the story, you can do that. It's hard, because then they just feel really sort of like stuck on. But I think by the segmented nature of this story, it kind of allows for a lot of those kinds of characters, you know, it sort of supports that, because it's very much set piece, set piece, set piece, set piece, as opposed to us following a whole, you know, cast of characters along through the whole thing.
So yeah, you can do it. It's just, I don't even know why you'd want to do it. It's not what they did in the film last night, because there is, of course, a relationship between Bagheera and Mowgli as well. But Bagheera and Baloo share the same perspective, and they're driven by non-accurate. Both Baloo is, you know, this is intolerable. He's always pointing out what's wrong or what's not living up to standards. And Baloo, obviously, is always coming from a place of not living up to standards. And at the end, they both change to a more accurate point of view. They go to the solution of accurate, where they tolerate. It's almost like, yes, okay, you can use these tools. And yes, you can try to live up to your potential. You know, you can try and get to be as accurate as you possibly can. So that's one way you could do it in your head. So if you listen to the user group meeting and you hear Sandy instantly jump around and he knows exactly where he's been doing it for slightly longer than me. He's an extra couple of years. He was there from the beginning. And that's because he knows that connection between the change character and the steadfast character, the idea that the problem and solution are shared between the change character and the overall story, and the symptom and response, which is where they focus most of their effort, is shared between the steadfast character and the overall story. Wow, so that's a huge bit of update there just to fill you up with there right at the very beginning. Jeez, I'm finished. I think I can stop now. And I still have a whole lot more to talk about. Another really, really fun part about last night was the round robin of going around and asking how people, why there was extra faces, why there were more people there, and what their experience with Dramatica has been. One writer last night, this was his first exposure to it, and he found it really enlightening, and I wanted to share with you what he thought about it.
It's awesome. Yeah, because I mean, kind of speaks to what you said, is explain to other people trying to understand the science of storytelling and whatnot. This definitely removes a lot of confusion when you're playing with so many typical characters you're pulling from mainstream media or movies you see in entertainment. This gives me a way to actually articulate what's in my mind, but it's a lot to take in, like you said. But you can unlock so much stuff with this. These are like a lot of little keys. Yeah, to really understand why isn't my story working? Why is this, you know, second act or third act not landing? Why is so? This seems like there's now a way to do it more than just the conventional. Here's act one, act two, act three. You know, this isn't readily available out there. Because you go online and Google search and you try to find ways to unlock story, but this definitely has blown my mind. It's like the Matrix right now.
So that's really great. It's very inspiring, and it's great to see that someone can see how creative and almost like the brainstorming part of it, the creative process of Dramatica and how it offers you more options and more opportunities to tell the stories that you want to tell. It gives you all kinds of ideas about it. I thought that was really, really great that he shared that with us. And then another writer who's a little more experienced in story rooms and pitch meetings and stuff, he shared his experience of what it was like talking or referring to Dramatica but not actually using the terms. Because as soon as you say it and you admit that there's this idea that you might be speaking about a system, or that there might be something in there, there might be some nefarious scheme going on behind your thinking, that instantly shuts everyone down. And I thought it was great because I've had this experience too, where I know, you know, as I just explained, when it comes to the relationship between the change or between the main character and the influence character, one changes their resolve and the other one remains steadfast. And if you have both of them change, it just breaks the story I don't think I recorded this last night, so I should get this down real fast. Chris gave a really great explanation how you can very easily prove to people that it's both people don't change. Because the idea that most people, they like the idea that both people change and they come to a synergistic place where it's like, oh, okay, we've both changed and now we're happier. But when it comes to a narrative and you're trying to create meaning and push or argue a particular point of view, if they both change, then the measure by which you evaluate that change is fluid. So you don't actually measure any kind of change. So that the meaning of the actual changed perspective is in relation to the steadfastness of the other. That's how you can tell that there was an actual change. So if both of them are changing, it's like you're both on uneven ground and there's no basis to stand on and there really is no change. So I've had this experience too, where you're in a story meeting and somebody's pushing this idea of both of them changing, and you want to say, "Well, no, they both can't change because then the story form will be broken." But if you say that, you know, that will, they'll just flip out and not want to be locked down by any kind of system, which unfortunately means the story will have no meaning and will be kind of all over the place. So you can either, well, from now on, I'm going to use Chris's example of how, well, the only way you can tell the change is by, you know, the standard by which they change, the way you evaluate it is by the other person's steadfastness. That'll be a great way to do it. But the other way is to actually just engage with them and find what it is that, what they believe or where they're coming from, and kind of use Dramatica, but you don't actually use the Dramatica terms. And it seems like it's better now. I feel like the whole idea of steadfastness, there seems to be more acceptance of it, that this is a possibility, this is something that's real. But it hasn't completely moved over to that. I think Chris mentioned last night that it's changed, but it's not more specific. So it's just kind of fluidly moving in a different direction, but no real concrete sort of point of view, which is what Dramatica provides. So if you ever want to come to a Dramatica user group meeting, they're great. They're in Pasadena the second Tuesday of every month. And we do different films, different genres. Next month is the very happy, pleasant Winter's Bone, which is not a very happy story, but will be great to see what the actual story form for that is. And then, of course, in December is the embroidery class, where we spin a random story form, and then we go around and create a story out of nothing, which I always think is a blast. If you haven't listened to those, it's every December, the user group meeting, and I'll leave a link to those in the show notes. And please stop by, and I will leave a link to the YouTube channel where I post all the videos. And of course, Chris records them and creates podcasts out of them. You can listen to those as well. Next up, hashtag storytelling. I have two posts this week in the blog. I have a new schedule now where I'm doing considerably more amount of writing, which is not a very well constructed sentence. I do more writing now, and I have two posts this week building upon the idea about current events and being able to find a story form in current events. And I just wanted to briefly mention them if you haven't checked them out already. You can always find them if you go on the front page of Narrative First and you go to recent updates. You can always find that's a link to everything that I post on the site. And I have two articles. The first one is about the narrative, and it's "The Narrative Is Not Real." And it's just a quick little blog post about meaning comes in the form of the stories we tell ourselves about the world. Whether you seek truth in the real world or honesty and sincerity in your own fiction, our mind's instinctual nature seeks out significance. And the idea is that everybody, the great big push for storytelling, like if you go to hashtag storytelling on Twitter or whatever, you'll see there's a whole industry of businesses telling their story, and you have to engage. Everybody understands that our minds love stories. And they think it's because we are instinctual storytellers. And the truth is, the reality is that stories are instinctually us. So that the way that they're actually constructed is form-fitted to the way that we problem solve. And that's the entirety of what Dramatica is all based upon, is this idea of a single human mind, an analogy to a single human mind trying to solve a problem. So it's a bit off when people say that we are natural storytellers, when it's more about the stories are naturally us. They're models of how we think and solve problems. So that's why we can't help but see stories everywhere, because stories are just reflecting back to us ourselves. And it's our perceptions that actually determine our reality. And I'm currently reading Barking Up the Wrong Tree by Eric Barker. And he talks about, you know, it's about how you can change the stories that you tell yourself so that you can improve your productivity and all that stuff. But the one part that he was missing, the essential part, was this idea that the reason why that is because of how stories are built upon the way that we problem solve. And the second blog post was referred to me by one of my clients, an article from The Guardian called How Do We Get Out of This Mess? And it starts off with Donald Trump, North Korea, hurricanes, neoliberalism. Is there any hope of a better world? Yes, but we have to come together to tell a new, kinder story explaining who we are and how we should live. And it's very touchy-feely and steps around storytelling and what it's actually about. But the idea is that, yes, you do need to, if you want to communicate to people, you tell a story. And I put forth the point that writing a complete story actually guarantees a successful broadcast of your message. It's like, yeah, you can tell a story, but if you don't know how a story is actually constructed, you don't actually know the mind's problem-solving process, you're going to miss out on parts and your story is going to be deficient. And if you leave out bits like Dunkirk or, well, Dunkirk's probably the best example, or Okja, that was another example this year, it swerves into propaganda and you're going to alienate probably a lot of the people that you want to communicate to. George Monbiot, wait, what was his name? Monbiot, George Monbiot, writing for The Guardian, says, "Stories are the means by which we navigate the world," which is great. "They allow us to interpret its complex and contradictory signals. We all possess a narrative instinct, an innate disposition to listen for an account of who we are and where we stand." That's close. Stories, though, possess a mind instinct. That's the difference. It's not that we possess a narrative instinct. It's that it's that stories possess our mind's instinct. So stories reflect the way that we think and solve problems. We don't possess an instinct for narrative. Narrative mimics our innate disposition for meaning. And I go on just to briefly talk about that and how a complete story simulates that process of either building up justifications or tearing them down. So a steadfast main character builds up justifications. It's this story process of building up to where a point where you're like, you know what, I'm justified in believing this way, which would be the story of Mowgli. A change main character tears those justifications down, which would be somebody like Sarah Connor, where it's like she's has justifications for why, well, this guy doesn't want to go out with me, this guy doesn't want to go out with me. And which is very funny because it's very simplistic because, what is it, the Bechdel test about how if you can write a story about women who aren't talking about their relationships with men, that would be an amazing test. It's something to that effect. And it's funny because James Cameron had his whole thing about how Wonder Woman set the clock back. And of course, Terminator would fail the Bechdel test because her whole main character through line is about guys. It's very funny. But her justifications are torn down like a change character. And stories reflect our mind's justification process. So it's either being built up in a steadfast character or it's being torn down in a change character. And that's because a complete story functions as an analogy to a single human mind trying to solve a problem. And Georges Monbiot came up with this concept of, or used the term narrative fidelity, which is great. I want to steal that idea. Let's see, what does he say? "When we ask ourselves whether something makes sense, the sense we seek is not rationality, as scientists and philosophers perceive it, but narrative fidelity." Like how close it is, how much it sounds like a narrative. That's such a great term. I love that. Narrative fidelity. I'm going to change the name of the site. "Does what we hear ring true with our mind's problem-solving process?" That's the narrative fidelity. That's like, oh, do I see myself in this that's being presented to me? I do? Oh, great. Now I'll actually listen to it. If the answer is no, then we sense the hole in the story. That's where it's like, oh, that story has problems because it's not actually reflecting that problem-solving process. If the answer is yes, and we do recognize ourselves, and we appreciate the full intent, and we absorb it. We actually appreciate the meaning and understand the message because we know where that story is coming from. So making a difference in the quality of storytelling requires a greater understanding of the mechanism by which a story progresses. And to me, that's the dramatic theory of story, and that's my whole purpose in Narrative First, is to help improve the quality of storytelling and help people tell better stories based on a better understanding of how narrative works. So those are two blog posts I will leave links to. And if you ever want to keep up to date with what is going on in the world of Narrative First, just go to narrativefirst.com/updates and you can read all about the story structure and story analysis goodness. We'll be right back. on to a surprise analysis of the week, my analysis of Seven, the very happy Kevin Spacey romp through dark and dismal Seven Deadly Sins with Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt. And I always have used this as an excellent example of a tragedy. When you look at the story points, the story dynamics of the story outcome and story judgment, you can create four different kinds of endings. You can combine, if you have an outcome of success and a judgment of good, that gives you a triumph. And I used to use, or I have examples of, and I have links, I will leave links to the series. And I used the examples of, I start out with Top Gun, because that always makes the kids laugh. What was the other? Amelie and the South Park movie. Those are all triumphs. Everything works out great, and everybody, the main character, is in a much better place. They've lost their angst. So that's a triumphant ending. If you combine a story outcome of success with a main character or story judgment, sorry, of bad, so success, bad stories, those are personal tragedies. So everything works out for the majority of people, but for the main character, it's bad. And I use the example of The Dark Knight. That's a great example of a success, bad story. And also The Prestige. That's another example of success, bad story. Those are personal tragedies. If you flop that and you do failure good, then you have the personal triumphs, which the classic Dramatica example is Rain Man. The Devil Wears Prada is a more recent one. And that's where the overall story fails, but it's good for the main character. I believe L.A. Confidential is another one of those. Those are the two bittersweet endings, the personal tragedy and the personal triumph. The last one, which is the failure bad, that's the tragedy. Those are all your Shakespeare plays, Hamlet, not Romeo and Juliet. Romeo and Juliet's actually success bad. And another one, that it's one of the ones that I used in the video montage, is the ending for Seven. So if you haven't seen it yet, you might want to go check out the Writing the Tragedy. I believe that's what it's called, Writing a Tragedy. But it's a series of articles I did a couple years back called Meaningful Endings, and they each have video montages, the same exact ones that I used to play for my students in CalArts, so I'll leave links to that. Unbeknownst to most people, before the Jungle Book analysis yesterday, I actually did another analysis prior to someone that I was introducing, a producer I was introducing to the Dramatica Theory of Story. And I always like to start out with, you know, what's your favorite film? And then we just use that film as a basis for going through and discussing the various story points and how Dramatica is actually able to predict a complete story, how you can actually fill in the blanks. And his first guess was Forrest Gump, or at least his first option was Forrest Gump, which I had not done yet and have been avoiding because it's a bit broken at the end, because she only asks him to take care of her kid because she knows she's dying of AIDS. So it's a little late. It's kind of like, well, now that I'm dying, I guess I'll change. When really, you know, she probably should have done that before she finds out. That would have had a little bit more meaning. So it's a bit odd, that film. So I wanted to kind of avoid that one. So I asked him his second favorite. His second favorite was Seven, which is hilarious because it's such a difference between Forrest Gump and Seven. And we went through, and there actually isn't an official analysis of the film. There is one online that somebody tried, which is close, but the thematics are off. But there wasn't an actual attempt to go through and figure out, you know, okay, where is the source of conflict in the story? So I thought it would be a perfect example. And I took a picture of the board so you can check out all the different craziness that went up there. And it looks like one of those boards with all the conspiracy theory things on there where they have everything tying everything together. And I'll, of course, that's going to be my analysis this week, and I guess it's going to be the Throughline Thursdays, so you'll be able to check those out, a visual representation of the different domains. But we were actually able to come up with a concrete story form. One of the things that was really super interesting to me was this idea where the issue is morality. So if you think about the Seven Deadly Sins and what it's all about basically teaching the world, showing everybody the error of their ways by basically it's a morality play. Like, you know, these are how immoral everyone is. And usually when you look at the issues of self-interest and morality, self-interest is always seen as a bad thing and morality is always a good thing. You know, doing what's best for others is always a good thing. Well, in this case, in Seven, doing what's best for others is actually a huge problem. It actually creates a whole mess of just like it's just not good. It's not good. These sins that he's trying to do, which he's trying to, you know, show everybody what's immoral and the moral way to live, that's actually creating more conflict and more problems in the story. Other funny things, you know, Detective Somerset, that's his main character. Morgan Freeman's, his name is Somerset, and of course the sun is setting on his life. It's very, I just think that's so cheap, I think, when you put the name and you make it mean something. It's like, you don't need to do that. You make the story mean something. You don't actually need to pile on this other really obvious name. And, you know, like Malcolm Crowe or Cole Sear, I See the Darkness. That stuff to me is, if you can make the story work, why would you need to actually do the name in it? When we were going through it, another interesting point was the goal of the story is what everybody's searching for to resolve the problems. And the consequence is what happens when you fail. So if you succeed, if it's a success story outcome, then you get the goal. If it's a failure story, then you get the consequence. And obviously we know 7 is a tragedy. So the consequence comes into place. Kevin Spacey wins. And how does he win? Well, at the very end, and I actually played the clip for the people in the room, at the very end, you know, Morgan Freeman has his flip out. He does his little change, and that kind of pushes Mills, Brad Pitt, over the edge, and he pops Kevin Spacey in the head. But right before he does that, what does Spacey say? They were saying, well, he wanted him to be vengeful. So Bean, oh, that makes sense. Bean playing a role. You know, we were using the older terminology, and they, well, it makes sense because he wants him to, you know, be vengeful, to play that role and to be a vengeful person. But that's not actually what he said. What he actually said was become vengeance, actually become vengeful. And that's the consequence. I just love that kind of thing where the story form that you find actually finds evidence within the film itself. So you have a failure story because they failed to stop him. That would have been the obtaining goal. And they failed by becoming vengeance. And that's where that story consequence is. If you want to learn more about this analysis and you're a Narrative First member, you can go to narrativefirst.com/analysis/7. And I'm going to spell it SEVE7. I'm not going to do SE. Actually, you know what? I'll do both. I'll do SE and the number 7. And I'll just reroute it so that you'll be able to get to it no matter which way you search, no matter which way you seek out the deep thematic analysis of 7, you'll be able to arrive at it. If you're not a Narrative First member yet, it's a great way to support the site and a great way to support your own understanding of story. You get access to all kinds of premium content, including all the professional story form analysis that I do on the site. And it will give you access to the 7 analysis. You can find more information about that at narrativefirst.com/membership. And finally, I didn't realize I was going to have so much to talk about today, subplots and the Dramatica story form. A lot of people, when they first come to Dramatica and they're used to other understandings of story and story structure, you know, they're told that the work itself is just one thing. So if you have the Save the Cat beats, you just look at the work, and that's where you find your different beats. Or if it's a hero's journey, that's where you find the different beats. And subplots are just there to kind of support that one sort of approach. The Dramatica story form allows for different story forms within the same work. So if you think of something like Lord of the Rings, the reason why it's 20 hours and the reason why it takes forever to end is because there's so many different story forms that have to come to an end. And what you can actually do is you can take that cast of characters and you can repurpose them for different roles in different story forms. So maybe in one story form, a character or a player, that's how Dramatica refers to it, a player is a main character in one story form and an influence character in another story form. This happens in Jerry Maguire. So both analyses are online on the Dramatica site. There's the sports story, which is Tom Cruise and Cuba Gooding Jr. And there is the romance story between Zellweger and Cruise. So Cruise is the main character in the sports story, with Cuba Gooding being the influence character. But he's the influence character in the love story, with Zellweger being the main character. And that's why the film is so long. It's much longer. It has much more breadth of emotional concerns because you're seeing two different main characters deal with two different issues, and there are actually two different story forms within that one work. The same thing happens in As Good As It Gets, the James L. Brooks comedy. You have two different story forms. You have the romance story between Melvin Udall and Carol Connolly. That's the Jack Nicholson character and the Helen Hunt character. That is one where Melvin is the main character in that story. And then you have the neighbor's story, which is Simon Bishop, the Greg Kinnear character, as the main character. And Jack Nicholson's character, Melvin Udall, plays the influence character in that. So again, you have two different story forms. The film is much longer. The emotional breadth of the work is larger, more expansive. But you have, you know, two different sets of thematic concerns and issues that people are dealing with, but the same players in both. So they just share, they both share the same narrative space, but what they're actually dealing with and what they're actually concerned with, where their conflict is coming from, is quite different. Last night at the user group meeting, somebody asked Chris about subplots and how that works and how you can tell whether or not you're dealing with a subplot, whether or not you're dealing with a subplot or you're dealing with the actual story form itself. And Chris came up with a great explanation for using subplots within Dramatica.
General question. Okay. Well, one of the things that's important to think about is that's one of the reasons why we call them sub-stories, not subplots. Because a sub-story can have character, plot, theme, and genre.
Right.
That is separate from the main story's character, theme, plot, and genre. Even though that you might share the storytelling, you might share a player, they're not the same story. So you can have the characters in one be assigned their certain characteristics, and in the sub-story, they'll be assigned a different set. So, for instance, let's say the protagonist in the main story is the contagonist in the sub-story. So you put them in a scene and you switch from the main story to the sub-story, suddenly that player is not going to be acting like a protagonist, they're going to be acting like a contagonist. They'll be acting tempting and hindering as opposed to pursuing and, you know, considering. So that's how you do it. So it's essentially, if you think of a sub-story, it's a completely different context.
Right.
So you walk home, you're at work, you're one way, you walk home, you're a completely different person. Now, you are the same person in both of those contexts, both of those places, but the stories are different. The context is different. Does your behavior at home change what you've done at work? No. Sometimes it can affect it because we're not stories. Stories are simplifications of real life. That's all you do is you just think of it as a separate piece, just reusing pieces that you already have in the other story.
In that kind of context, then, would you typically find that as a sub-story, your depth in the sub-story is somewhat equivalent to a novella or a very short story as far as the development goes in a genre, plot, theme, and I forget the fourth one.
Character.
It
depends. You know, by development, you might develop it fully and then only use a little tiny piece of what you've developed in the work itself because that's all you have the room for. The reason you develop it is so that you know that basically how a character is going to behave at whatever point in the story that you are introducing it into the work. So, for instance, I'll just use the same one that we use all the time, which is in Star Wars. You know, you have the sub-story with Han Solo and Jabba the Hutt, right?
Right.
We don't even see the whole Jabba the Hutt stuff until the re-release, but we don't need to, because the part we see is the part we see, and it's consistent with whatever happened before it, and it ends. And whatever happens after, it's consistent with wherever it's supposed to end up going, except for Han Solo's miraculous change of heart and coming back to save the end of the story, which was completely unbelievable, but quite satisfying.
But, you know, the point of doing that, there are only, what, two, three, maybe four scenes that are part of that sub-story. You have the scene with Greedo
right.
in the cantina, that little bit. You
Han
have...
Shot
what?
Han shot first.
Right. Then you... And whether or not that is... That they get, you know, ID'd because of the firing or because of something else that the, you know, stormtroopers come in and shoot at them while they're launching, that's a... We don't know, but it's, we assume it's something. It doesn't really matter. The next big time we see it is when they're on the Death Star and, you know, and Luke finds out that the princess is going to be terminated and Han, who is, you know, just moments before has said, I'm not, you know, I don't want to stay in this room. It's like, you know, shooting fish in a barrel. And then Luke says, let's go save the princess. And he goes, no, I'm not budging. Because, of course, in the main story, he represents oppose. Doesn't matter whatever you're for, he's against. You want to stay, he wants to leave. You want to leave, he wants to stay. That's what oppose does. It just opposes everything. So by introducing the sub-story at that point, where you've essentially locked yourself in a room and you can't get out because the characters have already are acting in their behavior and they would not normally leave under those circumstances, you bring in the sub-story where Han is no longer the skeptic. He is now the main character of his own story where he needs a lot of money. And Luke comes in acting kind of like a contagonist, tempting him with all this money. And so suddenly, Han says, okay, I'm game. So where he would never have said yes before, switch context to the sub-story and you can get the story moving again. All right? The next time we see that is when he's cashing in and loading up his ship, you know, about to leave right before the big battle of the Death Star. So, I mean, they just showed enough in there to, you know, to be consistent with whatever that big story, larger story was. Clearly, it expanded before and after the extent of the of Star Wars: A New Hope. But it was but because it was internally consistent, it didn't matter where you came in, the characters were behaving as they would in that context.
Okay.
So that's really one of the reasons why you want to do it from a plot point of view. You know, then from, you know, character and theme point of view, you do it because you want to explore more character or you want to explore more theme. In Schindler's List, there's, you know, the sequence that's in the, you know, with they're in the, not Dachau, but whichever camp they're in. And, you know, the story is about, okay, let's get these guys out of this camp. That's what it's kind of about. And, well, you don't need to spend a whole lot of time in the camp to go from everybody's in the camp and let's get them out and working at this other place. But from an audience reception point of view, if you just spent this much time in the, you know, in the concentration camps, it would look like you're really sort of minimizing how important and how horrible they were in the context of the historical record and the audience expectation. So they threw in a little sub-story with the commandant trying to become a normal human being and failing. But by doing that, it not only gave you a lot more time in that environment, but you got to see the horrors really close up. And it made it that much more gut-wrenching because it was a subjective story in that environment. And therefore, the proper amount of attention and time was given to it in the overall work, even though it really had absolutely nothing to do with the main story. You know, it just happened to have the players in it, but it really had nothing to do with the main story. So there are thematic reasons and character development reasons and story reception reasons why you might want to do it as well. Okay. So that's why, If you think of it as a sub-story, then you know, you've got a lot of different reasons you might want to go in there just because those are the parts that you're interested in and have nothing to do with the plot, per se. Or you use it as a plot device to get out of corners that you paint yourself into, which is what they did in Star Wars.
So as you can see, you can use subplots to kind of get yourself out of a jam if the characters are acting the way that they're supposed to and from an objective function sort of standpoint. You know, they're in that room and there's no way Mahan's always going to be a Poe's character. There's no way he's going to actually ever want to leave. You can bring in that subplot, which is obviously set up prior in the different sequences with the Greedo and the Jabba the Hutt sequence. You can actually bring that in and give motivation, you know, you give justification for why he would actually work against his overall story function within the main central story form. And then that plays out again when he comes out of nowhere and saves the day. It's very satisfying, emotionally satisfying, emotionally for sure, but probably doesn't make quite as much sense if you didn't have that subplot. So that's it for this week's podcast. A lot longer than I thought it would be. If you have any questions for me, please write to me at narrativefirst.com/contact, and I'll answer them here on the podcast. And if you'd like to collaborate with me in writing your story and actually learning Dramatica as we go about developing your story, you'll want to check out Deliberate Storytelling at narrativefirst.com/deliberate-storytelling, and we could start figuring out the story form or story forms of your work. Have a great week of writing, and I'll see you next time.